طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature historian Ilan Pappe, whose book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, documented from the Israeli military archives in excruciating detail, Israel's systematic attempt to eliminate Palestinians from their historic homeland in the 1948 war that led to the creation of the State of Israel and the creation of at least 750,000 Palestinian refugees and the destruction of over 350 Palestinian villages. This epic book established Ilan as a world-class historian and is a must-read. But today you will hear Ilan speaking in Washington, D.C. about the themes of his latest book, The Greatest Prison on Earth. It is a portrait of the devastating military occupation of Palestine today. Here is Ilan Pappe speaking in Washington, D.C.
As some of you may be aware, there is a new and exciting development in the study of Israel and Palestine. And this is the application of the settler colonial model or paradigm to the case study of Israel and Palestine. What is settler colonialism? We make a distinction between settler colonialism and classical colonialism. The settler colonialists are Europeans who were forced to leave Europe due to persecution or a sense of existential danger and who settled in someone else's homeland. They were at first assisted by empires, but soon rebelled against them as they wished to redefine themselves as new nations in the new places. Their main obstacle, however, was not their empires and the struggle against these empires, but rather the presence of native populations. And they acted according to what one scholar called the logic of the elimination of the native. At times, this led to a genocide, as happened here. At times, to apartheid, as occurred in South Africa. In Palestine, the presence of native population led to the ethnic cleansing operation in 1948 and ever since. The settler also saw themselves as the indigenous and perceived the indigenous as aliens. The paradigm explains well what lay behind the ethnic cleansing operations in Palestine in 1948. Regardless of the quality of the Palestinian leadership, the ability or inability of the Arab world to help, the genuine or cynical wish of the West to compensate the Jewish people for the Holocaust and centuries of anti-Semitism, Zionism was a classical settler colonial movement that wanted a new land without the people who lived on it. Hence, long before the Holocaust, the Zionist settlers acted upon the logic of the elimination of the native. And 1948 provided the opportunity for partial realization of the vision of a de-Arabized Palestine. However, in 1948, only half of the indigenous population was expelled, and Israel succeeded in taking over 78% of the coveted new homeland, a homeland demanded by a secular Jewish settler movement, Zionism, by using a sacred religious text, the Bible, as a scientific proof for their right to national sovereignty in the land, and hence the Palestinian, from this perspective, were seen as usurpers who took a land that was not theirs. The first settlers who came in between 1882 and 1914 could have not made it in Palestine without the help of the local Palestinians, whether it was for accommodation or to learn how to cultivate the land. But in their diaries and letters back home, usually written at the homes of Palestinians, they describe the local hosts as the foreigners who usurped our ancient homeland and destroyed it. The inability to get rid of all the Palestinians and the takeover of most but not all of the land is an incompletion that explains the Israeli policy towards the Palestinians ever since 1948. This is the background for the harsh policy towards the Palestinians left within Israel, the 1948 Arabs, as the Palestinians would call them, or the Israeli Arabs, as Israel refers to them. Until 1956, this community was subjected to further ethnic cleansing operations. Dozens of villages were expelled. In them lived people already regarded as citizens of the new Jewish state, whose declaration of independence promised to protect them, and yet they were kicked out by the settler state. Because already then, democratic values or aspiration gave way to ethnic purity and racism. Then they were put under a harsh military rule between 1956 and 1967 that robbed them of any normality in their life, where soldiers could arrest, shoot, or banish them at will. The settler colonial state saw its Arab citizens as aliens with the potential of becoming hostile aliens at any given moment. The book I'm presenting today, The Biggest Prison on Earth, claims that the settler colonial paradigm explains the Israeli policy leading to the 1967 war as it does explain its policy in the early years of the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In the book, the Israeli occupation itself, the actual occupation between the 6th of June and the 9th of June 1967, is not described as it would be in most history books as a defensive response to an all-Arab attack, but rather as an Israeli solution to the incompletion of the 1948 operations. Somewhere there is water. I don't know what is this. The paradigm of settler colonialism also offers an explanation for the major decisions Israel took after the war, decisions that expose that why there was no chance from the very beginning for any peace process based on a two-state solution. More than anything else, for me, it exposed the Israeli perception of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as two huge mega prisons that by now a third generation of hundreds and thousands of Israelis is involved in policing and maintaining as a way of life and which looks to them as normal and acceptable, while the rest of us, I hope, look with disgust, horror, and dismay at this brutality and inhumanity imposed on millions of Palestinians incarcerated in these mega prisons, and their only crime is that they are Palestinians. Nowhere in the world such mega prison exists, and yet Israel until today has been absolved for this inhuman monstrosity it created in 1967 and still maintains today. The settler state needed the remaining 22% of Palestine, as the borders of 1948 were described even by a dove like Abba Ibn as the Auschwitz borders. In the book I describe how from 1948 onwards, important sections of the Israeli political and military elite planned the takeover of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The plans moved into a more practical stage in 1963, when the principal politician who objected to the takeover of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, David Ben-Gurion, was removed from any significant role in Israel's political life. The book thus begins in many ways in 1963, when a group of senior officers and officials drew a plan called the Shaham Plan that would be implemented in 1967 to abolish the military rule imposed on the Palestinians inside Israel and moving this apparatus, the military rule, and imposed it on the Palestinians living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip after their planned occupation. Here is the first quote from the book. I'll have three quotes, I think, from the book itself. This quote described the 1963 meeting. It's called the University on the Hill. Givat Ram, the Hill of Ram, is a sprawling hilly neighborhood on the very western edge of present-day Jerusalem. Various government ministries, including the Knesset, part of the Hebrew University, and the Bank of Israel, are located there. Israelis of a certain age, ethnic origin, and socioeconomic background developed a very nostalgic attitude towards the place. The hill makes a very brief and pastoral appearance in Amos Oz's first and famous novel, My Michael, published in 1968, where he says, "Where a small herd of sheep graze alongside the Prime Minister's office. There are no sheep in sight today, and the grazing fields of yesteryears are long gone. They were replaced by an elaborate system of highways, metal gates, hanging bridges, and quite a beautiful rose garden. It is very unlikely that sheep were to be seen anywhere near the Prime Minister's office when Amos Oz published his book in 1968. But sheep did graze this hill when the Palestinian rural neighborhood, Sheikh al-Badr, was standing there. Few of its houses are still there today, next to the Crown Plaza Hotel, frequented by Israeli members of Knesset who do not live in Jerusalem. This village was gradually swollen by the city and became an urban neighborhood until it was ethnically cleansed by the Israeli forces in 1948. It was a famous spot in the city as it overlooked one of Jerusalem's most renowned landmarks, the Valley of the Cross. Tradition has it that there stood the tree providing the wood for Christ's cross, and this is why on that alleged spot, Greek Orthodox monks built an impressive monastery, still there today, caged between new Jewish neighborhoods and inlay roads. West of the monastery today lies one of the two main campuses of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. It is built on Sheikh al-Badr's confiscated land, sold to the university by the Israeli custodian of absentee lands, allegedly kept pending a decision about its future, but in reality sold to any Jewish individual or enterprise willing to pay a ridiculous low price for it. The university until 1967 operated only in Givat Ram, as the other campus, Mount Scopus, became no man's land and therefore inaccessible. After the June 67 war, many of the Givat Ram campus departments were transferred to the old new campus of Mount Scopus, which was expanded significantly over confiscated Palestinian land. At the same time the Givat Ram campus was built, and north of it, a new site for the Israeli government was erected. Whereas the buildings of the campus were modest in appearance and were soon covered by pleasant lawns and greenery, it seems that the charm of this hilltop did not inspire the architect who built the governmental site of the Jewish state. With very little attention to pastoral scenery or the biblical heritage, they opted for huge lumps of cement spread all over the hill, wounding the natural beauty of this crest of the Jerusalem mountains. In the summer of 1963, in both locations, a group of unusual students were enrolled on this campus and on this hill for a month-long course. They were almost all with legal background of one sort or another. Some of them were members of the military administration that was ruling the areas in which the 1948 Palestinians, the Israeli Arabs, as they were called then, lived under a strict rule that robbed them of most of their basic rights. Others were officers in the legal section of the Israeli army or officials of the Ministry of Interior, and one or two were private lawyers. They were invited by the Department of Political Science at the Hebrew University. The course included lectures on military rule in general and on the political situation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in particular. There was also a discussion held about lessons to be learned from Israel's military rule in the Sinai and the Gaza Strip in 1956 and inside Israel since 1948. A short introduction to Islam was also part of the curriculum, and it ended up with a lecture on how Jerusalem was cleansed in 1948 from its Palestinian citizens. This was followed by, I quote, a celebratory meal, and everyone was in excellent mood, as was reported by one of the participants. The presence on Givat Ram in 1963 was part of an overall new military strategy initiated by the Israeli chief of the general staff in 1963. The strategy was presented by the chief of staff to the army on May 1, 1963, and was meant to prepare the army for the need to run the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as occupied military areas. The West Bank and the Gaza Strip, of course, were not yet occupied, but the fact that 4 years before the actual occupation, the Israeli military was ready with a judicial and an administrative infrastructure for ruling the lives of 1 million Palestinians is highly significant. End of quote. Already 4 years before the actual takeover, it was clear that with the coveted new territory, the settler state would have new demographic problems. like all settler colonial movements before them, space and people were the two main factors troubling the future of a settler colony. The more territory you get, the more natives you have. How to eliminate them was the issue, and the answer and methods depended on the capacity, circumstances, and the ability of the indigenous population to resist. And this is how it worked from 1967 onwards. The decision of how to engage with the new demographic issue was rested with the 13th government of Israel. It was the most consensual government Israel ever had and ever will have. Every shade of Zionism and Jewish Orthodox anti-Zionism was represented in this unity government. This explains its ability to carve out a strategy that is still adhered to today. It is based on several decisions. The first was not to annex officially the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but also never to give up these territories as part of the space of a future Jewish state. This is how the geography, the space issue, was solved. As for the population, after some hesitation and quite substantial forced transfer of population, it was decided not to ethnically cleanse the rest of the Palestinians who lived in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The status of the population was to have some official connection with the previous powers, namely Egypt and Jordan. But basically, as the Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan, defined the new inhabitants of the Greater Israel, they will be, he told the government, citizenless citizens. A worried Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abba Ibn, inquired how long can people live in such a condition. Oh, Dayan answered, at least for 50 years. The next decision was not to announce these decisions and engage in a peace process with the help of the Americans, the aim of which was to obtain international, if possible Arab, and even maybe Palestinian, legitimization or at least consent to the way Israel will have the territory without the people, and this would be called peace. It was taken for granted that there will be a genuine public debate in Israel about the future of the territories and some friction with the Americans. But in the end of the day, the Israeli interpretation of what is peace and what is the solution, these ministers believed, would prevail. Nothing in what happened in the next 52 years indicate that these politicians did not get it right, basing their hope on Palestinian fragmentation, Arab impotence, American immunity, and global indifference. The message of having the land without the people and calling it peace was devised in the months of June 1967, and we have now the documents from those government meetings. The Labour Party, still dominating Israeli and Zionist politics, always believed that some land can be conceded for the sake of demographic purity. Hence, they were enchanted by the colonialist idea of partition, which also, alas, quite a few Palestinians fell over for years. Partitioning the new occupied territory was the way forward between a Jewish West Bank and a Gaza Strip and a Palestinian West Bank and a Gaza Strip. The first partition map was offered by Yigal Alon, the Minister of Labor. The Jewish space would be determined, he said, in June 1967, by colonization. He drew a strategic map that left only densely populated Palestinian areas out of the future Jewish West Bank and Gaza Strip. The problem for the 13th government and the ones that follow, the Golda Meir government and the Yitzhak Rabin government, was the new messianic movement Gush Emunim, which had a different map of colonization, based on the Bible and the nationalistic imagination of Israeli archaeologists, which wanted to settle Jews precisely in densely populated Palestinian areas. This twin effort from above and below, already by 1974, defined the West Bank in particular as a partition space between a Jewish West Bank and a Palestinian one, the former growing all the time, the latter shrinking all the time. The other constituent element of the settler colonial policy after 1967 was how to rule and police these citizenless citizens. In the last 52 years, as my book tries to show, the settler state employs two models of running the life of millions of citizenless citizens. Both models are mega prison models, with the logic of a prison, with the only one different that you can leave the prison and become a refugee with no right of return. One model was the open prison model, and the other one, the maximum security prison model. The open prison model is based on allowing freedom of movement inside the Palestinian areas and a controlled movement outside the Palestinian areas and between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. No spatial growth for the Palestinian is allowed. No new villages or towns can be built on any land coveted for the present and future Jewish state or settlements. No resistance would be tolerated to the geopolitical reality imposed by Israel, and a certain level of autonomy would be granted for running municipal affairs. The first open prison was run between 1967 and 1987. Life was constantly monitored by the army, and since 1981 by an outfit called the Civil Administration, ruled by a set of regulations that gave the military unlimited power in the life of the citizenless citizens. They were arrested without trial, expelled, their houses and businesses demolished, wounded and killed at the discretion of soldiers, quite often of lower ranks. This was on before 1967 and 1987 for the first time, and then between 1993 and 2000 for the second time. It is on offer today for areas A, B, and C in the West Bank since 2004. Every new model of an open prison is worse for the inmates than the previous one. Privileges granted in the first term are reduced as long-term punishment for resisting the model. Remember, this is the world of the jailer and the warden, and this is part of such a reality. So the second open prison, what one can call the open prison model of the Oslo Accord, which created mini prisons in areas A, B, and C and the Gaza Strip, is far less open than the one intact until Oslo. The didactic approach is inbuilt into the Israeli perception, supported by Israeli Orientalists, how best to teach the Palestinians lessons that would docile them and disempower them to the point of submission. The first Palestinian resistance to the open prison model was the First Intifada in 1987. The punishment was replacing the open prison model with a maximum security prison. Between 1987 and 1993, it included short-term punitive actions, mass arrests without trial, wounding and killing demonstrators, massive demolition of houses, shutdown of businesses and the educational system, and most importantly, further expropriation of land for the sake of Jewish settlements. Here I would like to bring another quote from the book for how the first model of maximum security prison was run. It's called the calendar of the occupation. A more diluted form of a closure was the curfew imposed by the army for a few days on towns and villages and during Jewish festivals on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as a whole. This kind of action began in 1967 in the early days of the occupation and continued on a daily basis. I chose only one year, 1993, on the very eve of the Oslo Accord, so as to show what kind of a reality the Accord promised and utterly failed to change. As one NGO monitoring the curfew policy noted, every Palestinian living in the occupied territories had spent an average of 10 weeks a year under a house curfew. The worst day in the calendar of the occupation, apart from the aftermath of a particularly daring or violent operation by one of the Palestinian factions, were the 3 days around Israel's Day of Independence, celebrated according to the Hebrew calendar, and that in 1993 fell in April. The town of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, like all the other towns and villages of the West Bank and the Strip, was put under military curfew for these 3 days. This short period was enough for the army to perform its routine devastation. Muhammad Ahmad al-Astal, who was 24 years old then, recalled how the soldiers burst into the house where his friends usually gathered, about 10 men all in all. The soldiers took 4 of them to another room. He remained with 3 others, members of the family. Two of those were taken by the soldiers to the room's corner and were beaten with the rifle stocks. They were punched, slapped, and kicked. He was ordered with another family member to empty the cupboard from all its contents, clothing and other household stuff. Here is the rest of the tale in his words. The soldier called me, slapped me on the face, and told me, "You are Hamas." I returned to empty the cupboard, but I was called again. This time they told me, "You are Islamic Jihad," and slapped me again. There was a third round when he was called, "You are a PLO." Another man in the room was treated in a similar way. They were both summoned. And he recalls, one soldier held me by the neck and banged our heads against each other. It turned out that in the next room, the same abuse was taking place, and they were united with two men from the other room and ordered to stand facing the wall with their hands stretched in the air. The soldier gave us back our ID card to hold up in the air and told us to remain like this. After half an hour, the older members of the family told them that the soldiers left. Hassan Abdel Saidi Abu Labada, 29-year-old, married with two children, also resident of Khan Yunis, was woken up by the soldiers at 2 a.m. in the morning with a punch into his face from a soldier's rifle, followed by additional blows. His brother Manar, 23-year-old, was taken out of his bed and thrown at the family's car parked at the yard. The soldier asked about the whereabouts of Abu Sahmanda, whom he had not known at all. This led to more punches direct to his eyes, followed by the usual routine of a forced emptying of one's cupboard. The soldier tore with a knife the sofa, and in his own words, "They found a kitchen knife in the kitchen. What is it? It's a bread knife," I answered. The soldiers punched me with a knife on the nose. I was wounded and bled. The soldier took a sack of rice and demanded that I empty it on the floor. I said it was only rice, so he emptied it himself and then took an oil tin and poured it on the clothes and the rice. They left. Nobody was arrested. Nothing was taken. Fatma Hassan Tabashe Sufyan was 61 years old, married, and a mother of four, and she woke up on the 6th of April 1993 at 3 a.m. in the morning. The soldiers broke into her house and pushed her towards the wall and asked her where her children were. "They were asleep," she replied. They woke up her son Saeed, 30 years old, kicking him and beating him with her hand and rifle stock until he was splitting blood all over the place. Her other son Ibrahim was badly beaten, and the B'Tselem researcher who took her evidence testified that long after the incident, he could still see ecchymosis stains on his back. Both sons were taken out of the yard and stationed against the wall. The soldier found two toy guns and began slashing the two with it until they broke. Then they gathered everyone in the complex, 27 persons in one room, and threw in a shock grenade. Saeed and Ibrahim were ordered to empty the cupboard while they were continuously beaten by the soldiers, shouting at them, "You are Hamas and we are Golani," the name of the military brigade to which they belonged. They did not spare a blind old brother of Fatma, 100 years old, who was abused by the soldiers, throwing mattresses and blankets at him. Thus, every April from 1987 until 1993, this was the routine of the collective punishment. But it was not these 3 days that matter. Collective punishment in the March to May 93 period robbed 116,000 Palestinian workers from their source of living, working in Israel, bisected the occupied territories into four disconnected areas, and as noted, barred any access to Jerusalem. Seen from that perspective, when the Oslo Accord was implemented as a territorial and security arrangement in 1994, it was just an official confirmation for the policy already in place since 1987. End of quote. The Palestinians were offered a sophisticated open prison model in Oslo, regardless of how Palestinians and the world saw the accord. This is why the end of occupation is not mentioned in the Oslo Accord, and the accord does not promise any end to the intensive Israeli involvement in the life of the Palestinians, even if the Palestinians would have implemented every Israeli demand under the accord. However, this model included the long-term punishment, the didactic one that I mentioned before. Since 1994, there was no freedom of movement anymore inside the Palestinian areas, let alone outside the Palestinian areas, and the Judaization of the West Bank increased. The Gaza Strip was encircled in 1994 with a barbed wire, and the privilege granted for the first model of the open prison for people in Gaza to work in Israel was withdrawn. Another permanent punishment was the allocation of more water to the Gush Katif settlements in the Gaza Strip and cutting the strip into two parts controlled by Israel. The water crime done in the open prison model are important to be revisited. And here is another quote from my book. Article 40 of the Oslo Accord was supposed to increase the water resources available to the Palestinian by almost 30 MCM. But only one-third of this promised quota was given. Even that additional quantity was lost in a policy of permits which controlled and distributed water as means of reward and punishment in the open mega prison, where the Palestinians' drinking water networks and ability to drill wells depended on the Israeli goodwill. Moreover, the Israeli National Water Company, Mekorot, tapped by the end of the century into mountain aquifers due to the drought and continued to do so in times of water shortage, while the Palestinians were prohibited from doing so even for agricultural purposes. Another problem Palestinians faced was Israel's demolition of water harvesting storage pools. According to the Palestine report, for example, in the Hebron area of Arub and near the Israeli settlement of Kiryat Arba, some farmers tried to build storage tanks to collect rainwater, but the Israeli authorities destroyed them. Palestinians were faced with a growing problem of pollution from water waste coming from the Israeli settlements. These settlements dumped their wastewater, especially industrial waste, into Palestinian lands on purpose. This polluted both agricultural lands and groundwater. As the report on which we rely for this description noted, clearly the contamination of water resources by residential and commercial development can have a deleterious effect on public health. The Israeli Daily Maariv reported the Palestinian children near prosperous settlements fell ill because they lacked water and suffered from poor hygiene. Tests carried in various parts discovered high level of bacteria, nitrates, and other hazardous industrial impurities, and as there was no alternative water resources, the population had to use these sources with incredible risk to their life. Palestinian health officials estimated that between 1994 and 1999, 66,000 Palestinians were hospitalized with water pollution-related illnesses, and another 290,000 sought outpatient care for such illnesses. When Palestinian villagers attempted in November 1999 to build a sand barrier to stop such a flow from the Jewish colony in Gaza, Kfar Darom, they were prevented by the Israeli army from doing so. The wastewater brought with them a dramatic increase in the number of mosquitoes and other insects and contagious diseases, particularly skin diseases among children. In 1999, in several cases, these water waste burst through dams and submerged cultivated land and at times even houses. In 2001, such an implosion was so dramatic that it was widely reported in the world. Some poetic justice occurred in the winter of 2012 when the water burst the apartheid wall near a Jewish settlement inside the Green Line, Beit Hefer, and flooded the houses. I do not mean that anyone drove satisfaction from watching Israelis suffering a similar fate, but just that when you corrupt the land as an invader, nature turns a blind eye to nationality or ethnic identity. The ecological damage of the occupation transpired towards the end of the century in other aspects of life. The settlements brought with them industries, aluminium, leather tanning, textile dyeing, batteries, fiberglass, plastic, and similar chemical industries whose waste is dumped near the Palestinian villages. Solid waste from Israeli industrial zone were routinely dumped in Palestinian areas. Wadi Beit Hanun, for example, is a receptacle for waste from the nearby Erez industrial zone. A report by the Palestinian Ministry of Environment stated that since 1987, Israel dumped solid waste in the Azun area near Kalkilia, leading to a marked increase in dangerous disease such as cancer among Palestinians in the area. The report reviewed the many attempts to smuggle Israeli solid waste into the Palestinian land. The report also warned against Israeli attempts to relocate factories causing environmental hazards from within Israel into the West Bank settlements and pointed out that 40 out of the 160 factories in the settlement pose real environmental hazards. That's the end of that quote. If life under the first model of the open prison was unacceptable to the Palestinian, the second one was worse, both in objective terms, but even more importantly, as it was presented as part of a peace process. The years devoted to Oslo and its implementation were creating life under conditions which were far worse than those in the first open prison model. The second uprising generated again a punitive maximum security model, far worse in its short-term punitive action and long-term punishments. The massive use of military power included F-16 and tanks against civilian population, in particular during the 2002 Defense Shield operation, an herbicide that we had witnessed in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen recently took already place in the West Bank in 2002. This barbaric assault was a prelude for the use of such power in the third model of the maximum security prison imposed on Gaza after the Hamas took over the Strip in 2006. In 2007, the two models clearly transpired in the way Israel rules the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, still loyal to the main decisions the 13th government took in 1967, not to annex, not to expel, and not to withdraw. The only decision discarded was the need to present it all as temporary measures pending peace, or to describe the open prison model as a peace plan. Even the Israeli public and politician got tired from this charade and adopted what Prime Minister Ehud Olmert called unilateralism. This is the reality today. Where there is collaboration, there is an open prison model. This takes place in Area A and B in the West Bank, which include the long-term punitive actions, hundreds of checkpoints, and an apartheid wall meant to humiliate to the point of submission millions of people under the belief that this would discourage a third uprising. The checkpoints are the cruel recruiting ground for a network of informants that is meant to attack the dignity and self-respect on a whole nation that miraculously still succeeds in remaining human and steadfast today. And the closure of whole towns and villages with only one exit, controlled day and night by the army and recently by private companies, complements this matrix of control of the present-day open mega-prison of the West Bank. Where there is resistance in the Gaza Strip, the maximum security prison has turned into a ghetto, with Israeli rationing food and calories, undermining the health and economy to the point of creating a human catastrophe, as acknowledged by the United Nations prediction that the Gaza Strip would be unsustainable for human life from next year onwards. The military punishment is no other than a set of war crimes, an incremental genocide of the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. This is achieved by dehumanizing the Palestinian, including children, depicting them as soldiers in an enemy's army that can legally be targeted as army forces. This was the same doctrine used in the Nakba in 1948. A village was an army base, a neighborhood was a military outpost, and whoever lived there were enemy soldiers, not men, women, and children. All the Zionist parties in Israel, in one form or another, subscribe to these two models as the only game in town. The dominant political powers in Israel wish to import this twin model now into Israel proper, vis-à-vis the Palestinian minority inside Israel, and they might succeed in doing so. And the newly passed nationality law is an indication that this indeed is the way forward. The only way of stopping it is first to recognize the settler colonial nature of Israel, and as a result to understand that what is needed is not peace, but decolonization, not just of the areas occupied in 1967, but of the whole of historical Palestine, one which will include the implementation of the Palestinian refugees' right of return. Secondly, we should go back and revisit the two-state solution as an open prison model and think hard how one can create one democratic state for all, taking into account two things. One, that the representative bodies of the Palestinians until today still subscribe to the two-state solution. And secondly, that there is already one settler apartheid Israel all over historical Palestine. Ergo, we need a Palestinian change of mind, an international endorsement of the BDS of a way forward, and then we might even succeed with some of the Jewish citizens of changing their mind, provided we can fight in the U.S. and elsewhere the ridiculous allegation that such a vision is tantamount to anti-Semitism. I would like to end in the seven. Thank you. I would like to end with the last quote from the book, with a protocol from the military court of 2006, which is a daily occurrence for any Palestinian kidnapped by Israel from any part of historical Palestine, that I hope sustains my claim that the mega prison is real and it can be abolished only by pressure and struggle and not by a peace process. Settler colonialism is a structure and not an event, and therefore any point in this brutal history that I would point to or illustrate to you is a point in time, but also a contemporary reality. The last quote from the book. If outside guests would visit any of the military or civil courthouse active in the business of occupation, they need not bother with long planning. They can choose any day in the week. In each location, thousands of innocent Palestinians undergo one of the most dehumanizing processes under the boot of a modern occupation. Below is a glimpse into half an hour in such a day in the life of a respectable citizen of the city of Nablus, who I will name here a Citizen K in homage to Kafka. K was under the category of manua, bend in Hebrew, namely not allowed to move out of Nablus in any direction. Here in this quote, we find out that manua has even more sinister meaning than just someone who is not allowed to pass through checkpoints. Here it means also someone who is denied any contact with a lawyer or meetings with their families while their interrogation takes place. You can be such a manua for a very long time, sometimes for years. For all the hundreds of reports one can nowadays easily access by volunteers who try and monitor a modicum of these trials, I chose the case of Mr. K for two reasons. Firstly, the defendant was a manua and hence not present in the court when the police requested the extension of his arrest. Secondly, this case involved an enthusiastic young lawyer, not yet worn down and dispersed like the rest of his colleagues who regard the proceeding in court as a charade and a lost case. His insistence of representing someone he was not allowed to meet, transformed in the court into a despondent attempt to discover the logic behind the systematic long-haul arrest without a trial, without anyone telling the prisoners or the lawyers for what reason. Due to his insistence, we can expose for a short moment what does it mean to be a Palestinian who lives in Nablus in 2006 or in 2019. Any Palestinian is in danger of finding himself or herself in such a nightmarish situation, whether he is a citizen of Israel, or of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or if he or she would be kidnapped from a refugee camp in Lebanon. Each one of them can be arrested, interrogated, denied a lawyer, and their cases would be brought for a trial for the sake of extending their detention every few weeks for years on end. As dictators bothered to have referendums, so does the Israeli legal system pride itself of bringing these poor victims for a proper discussion in court for extending what is called here in Israel, or there in Israel, in the local jargon, administrative arrests, a euphemism that is meant to calm domestic criticism and allow self-deception on part of those involved daily in imposing this brutal praxis. The system is so efficiently oiled these days that each such appearance in court becomes a very short procedure. I don't know if any one of you had been in such a court, but it takes usually 3 to 4 minutes. Any offense, from a parking ticket in East Jerusalem, loss of documents or failure to produce them in checkpoints, affiliation to a Palestinian group, bad family association, and just being in the wrong place in the wrong time exposes the average Palestinian to the scene I'm about to describe. So our hopeful young lawyer, obviously Palestinian himself, represented a friend of his, Citizen K, whom he knows well but whom he was not allowed to meet ever since K was kidnapped from his office in Nablus. I say kidnapped because he was transferred from the occupied territories in stark violation of the Geneva Convention to a civil court and jail inside Israel. Citizen K was a deputy manager in a local bank. When he was brought before the judge, he had already spent a month in jail. Kay was represented by a group of lawyers who en masse tried to represent a large group of Palestinians. On that day, there were all in all 15 people brought for extension of their arrest. The young acquaintance of Kay, our hopeful young lawyer, who comes from Nazareth, was part of the otherwise tired and pessimistic group of lawyers. Unlike his colleagues, he still wished to know why Kay was arrested. Needless to say, Kay was not present in the Petah Tikva court. His interlocutors were the judge, an Ashkenazi Jew, and a police prosecutor, quite often, as in this case, a Druze. The Druze serve in large numbers in the border police that operates within the occupied territories. They also dominate the warden's corps of the prison system, as they are the majority among the junior police and military prosecutors. They are 1% of the population, but they have been rewarded for the long-time collaboration with the Jewish state since 1948 with these jobs that turns them into the main vehicle of the for the occupying power in Palestine. Here is the verbatim discussion in court, and with this I will end. The lawyer, what is the allegation? What did he do? The police prosecutor, it is all in a secret report. The lawyer, what is he suspected of? The prosecutor, it is all in a secret report. I cannot say. He's engaged with a hostile organization. The lawyer, is there anything specific? The prosecutor, the activity and the involvement are all in the secret report. The lawyer, was he in contact with Hamas person? The prosecutor, I did not say this. The lawyer, can you tell me what are the allegations in a way that would not harm the investigation? The prosecutor, no. The lawyer, is it a direct activity or a suspicion that stems from his status as an inhabitant of the occupied territories or his presence in a certain place? The prosecutor, it is what he is doing, activity in the Hamas. The lawyer, did he admit the allegation? The prosecutor, it is all in the secret report. The lawyer, I would like to ask the court to instruct the representative of the police to answer. The judge, he cannot answer as there is no yes or no answer for this. The lawyer, I have to know whether my client admitted the allegations or denied them. The judge, after looking at the secret report, I find that there is no room for a reply. The lawyer, my client is detained for 34 days. Can I know what was done in all this time? The judge, do not ask him, the police representative, questions he cannot reply. The prosecutor, we ask for extension of detention for another 22 days. The lawyer, are you using this time to wear him out? The prosecutor, no. The lawyer, is this the reason why you cannot answer what you did until today? The judge, I'm here for you. You are the lucky one. Other judges would have told you, you have only two questions. Hurry up, ask what you want. The lawyer, the actions you need require 22 days. The prosecutor, this is a complicated investigation to justify a long period. The lawyer, what is so complicated? The prosecutor, it is all in the report. The lawyer, is the allegation of a contact with a Hamas person because he manages a bank? The prosecutor, not directly. The lawyer, so we are not talking about transfer of money. The prosecutor, it is all in the secret file. The lawyer in despair, it is all in the secret file, so what can one say? The judge, you are going to a shut door, then you try a window, and it is shut, too. You try, but do not be surprised, there are no answers. The lawyer, I thought we were in a democratic country. This is about human rights, not even civic rights. What can I ask about? The disappointed lawyer gave in and allowed his more experienced colleague to take over. Taking over meant not even trying a dialogue with anyone, just accepting the verdict of detention for a person who did nothing, had no access to a lawyer, and was not present. Still, one exhausted colleague, maybe stirred by the enthusiasm of his young friend, made a last effort. He noted that 34 days ago, when the defendant was brought to trial, even the Israeli judge was unhappy about the thinness of the evidence and wrote in his verdict, and I quote, I am extending the detention of the defendant, but I feel uneasy as it may concern an innocent man. The new judge was moved by this intervention and decided to extend this time the detention for only 18 days and not 22, as requested by the police. The defendant, a father of twins with bone defects, remained for a long period in the atrocious Israeli prison system, leaving his family without the bread earner, still not knowing what he's blamed for and when will he be released. He's still in jail today. He's one of the thousands arrested in such a manner in 2006, and the hundreds of thousands who were processed in such a manner since 1967. This was a relatively long process. The other 14 Palestinians on that day were resent to jail by the efficient production line. The massive numbers involved blunted everyone concerned, from the judges, the prosecutors, to the lawyers of the defense. Witnessing it once, you cannot escape the banality of the evil involved here and its quick and routine efficiency. Thank you.
You have been listening to historian Ilan Pappe speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.